Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei slams what he calls the arrogant tone of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal towards the Islamic Republic. Iran says all those involved in the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani must be held accountable. Georgia's police have arrested the leader of the main opposition party amid protests over last year's parliamentary vote. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has slammed as arrogant the tone of the U.S. and the three European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Ayatollah Sayyed Ali Khamenei also denounced the West for failing to fulfill its commitments under the accord. Now, in the meantime, Iran has announced the termination of its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyed Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust, and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France, and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework around this whole thing here is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in five gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors, as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
Political commentator Frank M. Speck says that Iran has made it clear that it will not be pushed around by the U.S.
If the United States is going to re-enter the agreement, the conditions sort of have to be there for it. President Biden can't look like he's caving into Iran. And of course, Iran has made it very clear they're not going to be pushed around by the United States. So what steps can be taken to allow the countries to come together? Well, one of them was obviously over this weekend, where the European Commission or some group of Europeans was pretty clear, I think, the United States, that enough was enough and that we should try to find a way to move forward. Here in this country, the Iranian issue is not front and center at this point. Nobody is banging the drum here except some very small section of, at the moment, I would say the Clinton wing of the State Department. But by and large, the focus is on the disaster in Texas, and of course, the stimulus package. So foreign policy issues are not front and center. And in a certain sense, that gives Biden enough breathing room, perhaps, to make the moves necessary.
Iran says all those involved in the assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani must be held accountable. Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Mohammad Bagheri, said that Soleimani's killing was an obvious crime and an act of state terrorism. He said that Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Jordan, and Kuwait assisted the U.S. in its assassination of Soleimani. Bagheri stressed that all of those who helped Washington commit such crimes must be held accountable. He said that American planes targeted Soleimani's vehicle with armor-piercing weapons. General Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander were killed in a U.S. drone attack near Iraq's capital, Baghdad, in January of last year. The commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says resistance is the best way to achieve victory. Brigadier General Ismail Qahani said today the resistance movements in the region are stronger than ever. He said the U.S. and Israel have failed to achieve their goals in the region. Qahani also hailed efforts by assassinated Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in fighting terror groups. Qahani slammed the U.S. for killing Soleimani and said that his path will continue. Iran's foreign minister says that regional countries are misguided if they believe that they can ever buy security from outside of the region. Mohammad Javad Zarif said at a gathering in Tehran that Saudi Arabia and its allies have been spending billions of dollars on weapons sales and proxy wars against Iran. Zarif said this has led the West Asia region to account for 25% of global weapons sales, and yet this has not boosted regional security. The top diplomat said that the Saudis and others should learn a lesson from their past mistakes and help open up a new window to the region. He said that's possible through security talks away from interference by countries outside of the region. Georgia's police have arrested the leader of the main opposition party amid protests over last year's parliamentary vote. Mika Malia was detained during a raid on the headquarters of his United National Movement Party in the capital, Tbilisi. Footage from the raid showed officers dragging him from the building. Media has been placed in pretrial detention. Riot police also used tear gas against his supporters who protested outside of the party's headquarters. Georgia has been in turmoil since last year's parliamentary elections, which saw the ruling party score a narrow win. The opposition claims the vote was rigged. Russia has criticized the European Union for imposing new sanctions on the country over the Navalny case, calling the measure unlawful and a cause of disappointment. The Russian Foreign Ministry said the sanctions were prepared under a far-fetched pretext. It added that the bloc had missed an opportunity to change its course with regards to Russia. On Monday, the European Union agreed to impose sanctions on four Russian officials in response to the jailing of opposition figure Alexei Navalny.
In response to events around the situation of Mr. Navalny, we reached a political agreement to impose restrictive measures against those responsible for his arrest and sentencing and persecution. And for doing that, for the first time ever, we will make use of the European Union global human rights regime to this end.
Two EU diplomats said no names were discussed when the bloc's foreign ministers agreed on the sanctions, but they said the bans are likely to hit Russia's director of prisons and prosecutor general, among others. Earlier, Moscow called on other countries, including the U.S. and the EU nations, to stay out of Navalny's case, calling it an internal issue. The Kremlin critic lost an appeal against his three-year prison conviction this week. He was detained on February 2nd for violating a 2014 parole, a charge he denies. Spanish protesters have clashed with police during a fresh rally over the jailing of Catalan singer Pablo Hasél. Protesters in Barcelona were met by lines of riot police and police vans. They threw bottles and other objects at law enforcers. They also made barricades out of rubbish bins and set them ablaze. This was the seventh night of clashes after the rapper was jailed for allegedly glorifying terrorism and insulting royalty. Hasél is known for his anti-establishment raps. His nine-month sentence has prompted debate over the freedom of expression in the country. Several people have been injured and dozens detained since demonstrations began in Barcelona and several other cities. After imposing a grueling months-long lockdown over the coronavirus outbreak, the UK government has announced a gradual easing of social restrictions, signifying perhaps that the country's vaccine program has started to bear fruit. But as Saeed Purizar reports, with thousands of people still in the hospital with the illness and the efficacy of the vaccines yet to be proven, the government is urging everyone to not throw caution to the wind.
The highly anticipated February 22nd announcement is finally here, marking what the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson calls his roadmap out of lockdown, following pressure from members of his own Conservative Party to explain how he plans to reopen the country.
We cannot persist indefinitely with restrictions that debilitate our economy, our physical and mental well-being, and the life chances of our children.
But restrictions won't be lifted in one fell swoop. Measures will be conditional based on four tests, with the government set to examine the data at each stage before unlocking further.
One of the first places to reopen, schools, which the Prime Minister, not long ago, described as potential vectors of transmission, causing the virus to spread between households.
In the devolved nations of Wales and Scotland, pupils have already gone back to school. We asked a number of parents in London what they thought of their kids returning to classrooms.
Well, they've lost nearly a year of schooling, so they definitely need to get back to school.
As long as people are sensible and the schools, I think, they've taken all the necessary measures to keep the children safe, then I'll be glad for him to go back to school.
There is still some risk involved, I suppose, but I'm hoping that, you know, as the vaccination program is going forward, and I hope this decision is supported by data.
Critics, among them leader of the opposition Labour Party, have criticized the government for missing the opportunity to jab the teachers and school staff.
If we'd used that last half term, that last week, to vaccinate teachers and school staff, we'd be having a better discussion about children back to school. But ideally on the 8th, I'll listen to what the Prime Minister says this afternoon. I hope he's got a good plan.
The government says it does, and that it hasn't vaccinated teachers and school staff for a reason.
There isn't strong evidence that teachers are more likely to catch COVID than any other group, because children are very, very rarely get symptoms and serious illness from the disease. The value, the importance of vaccinating children is to try to stop the spread of the disease.
At the moment, although death and infection numbers have gone down, there are still almost 20,000 people in British hospitals with COVID-19, and it's going to take months before everyone gets their first jab. It remains to be seen if this is indeed the beginning of the end for lockdowns in this country. Saeed Purizza, London.
The UN says civilian casualties in Afghanistan escalated sharply after peace talks began last year. According to an annual report by the UN mission to the country, civilian casualties stood at more than 8,800 in 2020. That was 15% lower than the previous year. However, the report suggests a sharp uptick in historically high civilian casualties in the final 3 months of 2020. Casualties for the fourth quarter were up 45% compared with the same period in 2019. The Afghan government and Taliban militants began peace talks in September of last year. The talks were stalled for weeks and were just resumed on Monday. There's uncertainty over whether international forces will leave the country by May as originally planned. Meanwhile, Afghanistan has launched its coronavirus vaccination campaign. Doctors, security personnel, and journalists are to receive shots during the first stage of the inoculation program. The Afghan President Ashraf Ghani says 500,000 doses of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine will be used in the first stage. The jabs were donated by India earlier this month. Kabul has recorded over 55,600 COVID infections, including over 2,400 deaths. However, the real figures are believed to be much higher due to limited testing. Amin Alami is our correspondent joining us from Kabul. So tell us more about the vaccination campaign, the rollout, and whether it's really accessible for all.
Well, finally, the Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani officially launched the implementation of coronavirus vaccination today here in the Afghan presidential palace. Representatives of doctors, nurses, media workers, and Afghanistan's armed troops were present during the ceremony, and they received this vaccine. According to top Afghan officials, the vaccination campaign will go through all Afghanistan. According to Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani, this is a great opportunity for the people of Afghanistan to receive this vaccine. He also thanked the Indian government for donating 100,000 doses of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccines to the Afghan government. In the meantime, the acting minister of Afghanistan's public health ministry, Waheed Majruh, also said that we are not expecting that all of the problems on the way of the Afghan people will be removed under the implementation of COVID-19 vaccination campaign. But he also stressed that we are doing our best to help the people. But let's not forget that there is a very big problem on the way of not only the Afghan government and its health bodies, but also on the way of international health organizations, including WHO, because they say that most of the areas in Afghanistan, mainly in rural areas, are under the control of Taliban militants. Despite the Taliban had confirmed that we will welcome medics to our territory, and we will also help them to implement vaccination, implement their programs across our region. But this is not clear. Will the Taliban be honest regarding to this promise or not? The Afghan government, the people of Afghanistan, and many rights bodies and even international bodies are calling on the Taliban militant group to not target medics, educational trainers, and even civilian employees of the Afghan government during their work time in different areas under the control of the Taliban militant group. But in the meantime, another important problem or another challenge that is on the way of the people of Afghanistan is, of course, the rising bloodshed and insecurity.
Okay, thank you for that. Amin Alami, we appreciate our correspondent there talking to us from Kabul. On to Myanmar. Anti-coup protesters there have held new rallies despite a heavy security presence by the army. People hit the streets in the largest city, Yangon, demanding their civilian leaders to be reinstated. They also want the release of the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and other officials from detention. Three protesters have been killed and nearly 700 others arrested since anti-coup demonstrations began earlier this month. The army has warned that confrontation could cost lives. Meanwhile, a civil disobedience campaign against military rule has continued. Myanmar's junta leaders seized power on February the 1st. They alleged fraud in November elections, in which Suu Kyi's party won against a pro-military party. And that is for World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of this series. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's high attention to ethics, especially among the students of seminaries. As a matter of fact, ethics and moral merits are the missing of the modern mankind. This time we are going to talk about Imam Khomeini's undeniable role in revival of spirituality and moral values in the contemporary world. According to many experts, modernism has inflicted serious damages on human life and environment, although it has brought about achievements for mankind. Some experts have divided human crises into two categories. First are those crises that are the outcome of man's opposition against himself and God. Second are the crises that result from man's opposition against the society and the world. As for the first group, modern man has been trapped in a sort of personal identity and alienation. Today, with the dominance of tools, many aspects of human nature have been neglected and human emotions have been pushed to the margins. Humanism, as dominant ideology of the 20th century and onwards, has dragged man to skepticism. Thus, he has become alienated and left alone in nihilism. Moreover, due to the lack of balance between individuals' relation with the society and the outside world, a big number of crises have gripped him. Excessive exploitation of nature as the source of welfare and comfort has caused intensive environmental crises and taken man to the precipice of eventual destruction. Generation gap has increased among communities and family as the most important unit of life, has reached to the threshold of disintegration. Extravagant consumerism has distanced man from balance and turned him into a being devoid of identity. That's why he doesn't bother pondering on his fate. The status quo has not only failed to bring calm for man, it has also aggravated internal turmoil incessantly. In view of all these social and spiritual miseries, Imam Khomeini's movement was definitely the greatest phenomena for revival of spirituality and identity among human beings. Imam Khomeini put a novel pattern ahead of mankind. He revived the spirituality in the forlorn world. He maintained that Islam is the best model for arrangement of human life and establishment of a government, owing to its simultaneous benefiting from reasoning and spirituality. He said, "Islam is the source of human salvation. Islam has come for building human being. It has come to lead humans to light, unlike rebel." Imam Khomeini considered inclination toward spirituality and morality as the key to salvation and happiness. He believed that mere material welfare cannot bring salvation. Therefore, he said, "We should try to invite people to spirituality and morality. Perhaps many would think that material welfare and having a lot of money in banks, owning real estate, etc., will bring salvation. But this is a mistake that man makes." Imam Khomeini considered lack of spirituality as the main disease of human society, saying, "We and our nation are boastful of following a religion that has rescued the Quranic realities, which are all calling to unity among Muslims from graveyards and as the greatest savior of human being from all shackles that have been tied on his feet, hands, heart, and intellect, leading him to take him to destruction and slavery of rebels." Imam Khomeini's approach was not limited to the individual life of mankind. Rather, he believed that spirituality should be reflected in the establishment of government and political structure of statesmen. Otherwise, the ruling system would be the system of rebels or ungodly rulers. Imam Khomeini defining the format of religious popular rule as the political system of the Islamic Revolution ruled out any kind of despotism and restriction of political freedom and adopted clear stances against colonialism by big powers. He deemed revival of spirituality as the ultimate goal of establishment of government. Exactly for this reason, he used to emphasize that any seeking of worldly pleasures and post and plunging in materialism would lead to the decline of the Islamic State. He maintained that achievement of freedom, independence, justice, and civilization building can materialize only through sticking to spirituality and morality. He strongly opposed development and progress without spirituality. He believed that such development and progress will lead to monarchy and corruption. Impressed by Imam Khomeini's thoughts, French thinker Michel Foucault criticized modernity and was of the opinion that it has alienated human beings from morality. He believed that the Islamic Revolution has defeated modernist current. In his view, Iran's revolution has tried to show the spiritual aspect of life. He maintained that collective will acts like God. Hence, no one can confront it. That's why he refers to Islam as the barehanded revolutionaries to triumph over one of the most modern armies. He said Imam Khomeini is the person who can save the 20th century man from the disease of lack of spirituality. He opined that what differentiates the Islamic Revolution from other movements is that it combined reason with spirituality.
The debate.
If you thought white supremacists was a U.S. problem, think again. According to the UN, white supremacists and neo-Nazis are becoming a transnational threat. Why would this elevate to a threat level at this point? Another key question, how have the groups taken advantage of the pandemic to boost their support? That's what the UN has said. Just some of the questions we will be asking our guests in this edition of the debate.
The UN Secretary General says white supremacy and the rise of neo-Nazi groups are becoming a transnational threat, warning that the coronavirus pandemic is not helping things. Antonio Guterres told the UN Human Rights Council that risk amounts to terrorism.
We must also step up the fight against resurgent neo-Nazism, white supremacy, and racially and ethnically motivated terrorism. The danger of these hate-driven movements is growing by the day. Let us call them what they are. White supremacy and neo-Nazi movements are more than domestic terror threats. They are becoming a transnational threat. These and other groups have exploited the pandemic to boost their ranks through social polarization and political and cultural manipulation.
Guterres did not name any states, but he warned that groups preaching hate are now the number one internal security threat for several countries. The U.S. has been under the spotlight for racially motivated tensions over the past years, more than any other country. Racial tensions simmered under the presidency of Donald Trump, with some months-long protests triggered by the murder of unarmed African-American George Floyd in the hands of white police officers in 2020. Many described it as the most serious social unrest in the U.S. since the civil rights movement of the 1960s. But at least for U.S. officials, nothing was as serious as the siege of the Capitol Hill building, but what incumbent President Joe Biden called thugs, insurrectionists, political extremists, and white supremacists. Guterres hinted at the incident when he warned of hate groups being cheered by people in position of responsibility. Trump openly slammed anti-fascist protests against right-wing extremism amid cheers by white supremacists. But he's not the only Western leader to have attempted to bring back pro-racism rhetoric to center stage. Far-right political parties are now a new reality of politics across Europe. The continent has also been struck by neo-Nazi protests. Far-right politics and protests have been taking different forms, with Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands being some of the hotbeds recently. But a few commonalities tie them all together. They attempt to revive toxic notions of white superiority by stoking fear of religious, ethnic, and racial minorities with a focus on Islam, immigrants, and non-whites. That's sugar-coated with models of defense against threats encroaching on what they tend to call accepted Western values. In May 2019, Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini led a rally of his European far-right allies in Milan. There, he vowed to remold Europe by crackdown on immigrants while protecting the perceived European civilization. That was foreshadowed by international gatherings of neo-Nazi groups in Germany, Poland, and the U.S. Guterres now warns that this is leading to a growing network of hateful ideologies.
Individuals and groups are engaged in a feeding frenzy of hate, fundraising, recruiting, and communicating online, both at home and overseas, traveling internationally to train together and network their hateful ideologies.
The rise of far-right has led to a surge in attacks on minorities in Western countries, including Britain, France, Germany, and the U.S., where authorities have been reporting hundreds of racially charged attacks on Muslims and mosques for over the past years. During the coronavirus pandemic, such incidents have also taken the new shape of certain restrictions on minorities' access to medical care and vaccines. Warnings like the one from the UN chief have been there for some time, but a problem lingers on in the absence of meaningful action from Western governments.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, editor at Culture Wars online magazine, E. Michael Jones, joins us from South Bend, Indiana. We also have author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. If I may first start with you, E. Michael Jones, and ask your reaction about what the UN has said, what the UN has warned us about, that white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups are becoming a transnational threat. Tell us how that has happened, in your opinion, and why has it become a threat now, not before?
Let me begin by saying, in all the years that I've been contributing to Press TV, this has got to be one of the dumbest, most preposterous statements I have ever heard in my life, okay? This is a complete fabrication on the part of the oligarchs to demonize a group of people who are simply trying to stay alive and survive under really horrible conditions. I'm talking about the United States of America. Okay, I'm going to go one step further, and I'm going to say there are no white people in the United States of America. White is a political category that is based on certain characteristics that gets imposed on groups of people for political purposes to demonize them. That's what's going on here. It's that simple. There's no threat in the United States, and there's certainly no international threat. This is pure oligarch speech.
So, okay, pure oligarch speech there, Jonathan Fryer, is what our guest there is saying. And also, if I understood him correctly, he has blasted the statement coming from the UN. In particular, it came from the UN Secretary General that is calling or is making the statement white supremacists in reference perhaps to the U.S. here. Is E. Michael Jones there justified in his anger, I should say?
Well, I listened with great interest to what Michael had to say, but I disagree completely. I think that the UN Secretary General was quite correct. There really is a problem, not only in North America, but also here in Europe. Indeed, European intelligence agencies, including the British MI5, the Internal Intelligence Agency, have stepped up its monitoring of far-right white extremist groups and individuals ahead of the previously the attention focused mainly on Islamist extremists. There really is a problem, and this has got worse during the COVID pandemic. We saw it with the Proud Boys who marched with others on the Capitol Hill last month in Washington. We've seen it here in Britain and in other European countries. And several far-right politicians have taken advantage of the proportional representation in countries like the Netherlands to win seats in the parliament of the different countries. And indeed, Marine Le Pen, the head of the right-wing group, which is overtly anti-Islamic, is highly likely to win at least the first round of the presidential election, though she may be defeated in the second round, thanks to the French political system.
Mm-hmm. Well, E. Michael Jones, the anger that you expressed on what the UN Secretary General has said somewhat parallels what the U.S. President Joe Biden said recently, that white supremacists are the greatest domestic terror threat in the U.S., calling what people who support them or their ideals demented and dangerous. I'm guessing you don't agree with Joe Biden, do you?
No. The Secretary of the UN got it from Joe Biden. It's obvious. This is the oligarch narrative. Okay, I have a question for my colleague in London. Okay, is Mr. Salvini white?
He would self-identify as white, and I, unfortunately, many of the supporters of the Liga in Italy are supporters of white supremacy. And although the white European might be a broad definition ethnically, it's what people identify as. And in America, there's a group, not just the Proud Boys, other groups who have targeted non-white immigrants, particularly coming from Central America and Mexico, and also Islamic groups. Here in Europe, it's more the Islamic minorities in countries like France and the Netherlands, but they self-identify as white, and quite rightly say there was an awful lot on Twitter at the time, Black Lives Matter, of white people standing up as White Lives Matter, We Matter.
Okay, go ahead, E. Michael Jones.
Yeah, there was an article in the New York Times when the Italians became white. Okay, there was a time here in America when Italians were not white. Okay, now we have a situation where this category of white is being imposed on anybody that the government doesn't like. Okay, so I was involved in this situation here this summer. St. Louis, there's a statue. Everybody's tearing down statues this summer, and there's a statue of St. Louis, the patron of the city. Okay, this statue has to come down. Well, why? I mean, it's not Robert E. Lee. What's going on here? Is St. Louis white? So the man who's orchestrating this campaign says it's white supremacists who are defending the statue of St. Louis. Well, you look into the story, and it turns out those white supremacists are praying the rosary. Is this something that white supremacists do? No, it's something that Catholics do. And so what we're seeing here, the classic example of what I'm talking about, this is identity theft. Anytime you use the word white, you are engaging in identity theft. And so the whole narrative here is, as soon as you identify a group as white, they've lost the battle. Because as soon as you're white, you're racist. And as soon as you're racist, you have no rights. So I entered into this discussion, wrote an article on it. Within hours of posting the article on the internet, this guy, Umar Lee, challenges me to a debate in which I, at the debate, I changed the narrative. So it's not a battle between white supremacists and black people. It's a battle between Catholics and Jews, because the Jews are the only people who are concerned about Louis, the King Louis of France, because he burned the Talmud. This is a type of misdirection that is being orchestrated by the people who run the show now in the United States, and now the idiots who are in charge of the United Nations are too stupid to understand what's going on.
I think we got six topics out of what statements there that E. Michael Jones just made. I'm trying to break that down in my head. I'm having a tough time wrapping my head around some of the things that you said, E. Michael Jones. I'm going to come back to you, though, because I'm going to give the floor now to Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan Fryer, there's a map that has about 20 countries in Europe that have nationalist parties that came into power just very recently. You can talk about, well, gosh, that covers quite a number of countries, Italy, France, Spain, you name it. Why have white nationalists actually struck such a chord with the population itself, at large, I should say, for them to come into power and hold political posts?
Well, because essentially they've been talking to grievances among a certain proportion of white people. But I think we need to make the distinction between white people and white supremacists. Although white supremacists are white as they see it, they are nonetheless very different from the majority of white people who have embraced the multiculturalism of the European and indeed European Union and of the United Kingdom. But what we've seen right across Europe, from Hungary through to Spain and Portugal, is the recent arrival of a strong minority opinion amongst white disenfranchised people who feel that they have grievances against the state, either the state is handling the COVID epidemic badly, or that they ought to get the virus protection, the vaccine, before the minority communities. And we're seeing a very difficult situation here in Europe. As I say, it's definitely happening. It's not a figment of imagination of Antonio Guterres, and it's not even something that's coming originate from the United States, I don't believe. I really think there is a problem here in Europe that's been developing over several years, long before the pandemic began, and which is largely because of the large influx of Islamic migrants to Hungary and Poland and other parts of Europe who came from Syria in particular. And although Germany opens doors and welcome, the right-wing groups in other countries, on the contrary, have been very antagonistic to these new arrivals. And we've seen within the Mediterranean countries, Italy, Spain, and so on, a backlash against these new arrivals, and the backlash against Islam. I don't agree at all with Michael, who said that this is a Christian or Catholic versus Jews. This is more Christian civilization versus Islamic civilization. For those of Britain, the majority, it's not a problem. But for white extremists, it is a problem.
Okay, well, E. Michael Jones, I want to go back to your statements there. And please walk us through, if you can. And the first angle that I'd like to ask you on is your general statement where you said the U.S. is not white. I'm trying to understand why this label white now is being used in your eyes by the government, what the reasons are, the motives behind the government to look at it in the angle and lens that you are. I mean, if you can back that up for us a little bit here.
Yes, yes. The motive is political control. As soon as a group is white, they're bad because they're racist. So if they can get you to identify as white, you already lost. Charlottesville, classic example of what I'm talking about. So what is a white guy? Okay, there are people who identify as white. It's a Protestant, doesn't go to church anymore. Okay, and what I'm talking about now is the real theory of ethnicity. It's a word we have to bring up here. Ethnicity is the antithesis of race in this instance, okay? And there There's a theory about American ethnicity, and it's called the triple melting pot, a sociological theory, that says after generations in America, your ethnicity is determined by your religion. That is what happened in St. Louis. So there are three ethnic groups in America. They're Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. That's your identity. That's your ethnic identity in America. That's what the oligarchs are trying to destroy. That's what I restored when I wrote the article about St. Louis. That's the real dynamic about what's going on here. Whether my colleague agrees with me or not, that's the story in America. It's ethnic. And I'm not white. I'm biracial. I'm Irish and I'm German. Now, how that these things are all being erased in a massive campaign of identity theft.
Well, this brings about the whole notion of going to waste, Jonathan Fryer, of multiculturalism, whether it's religious multiculturalism or any type that would fall under that umbrella, from, as I mentioned, religion to race to you name it. But we're having consequences of tensions which has amounted to violence and acts such as xenophobia. I mean, that's what happened in Europe, that forced the MEPs in the European Parliament to take firm action against neo-fascist, as they call the neo-Nazi groups. And maybe some people don't know what a neo-fascist group perhaps is. So hasn't the negative notions, what is at the heart of this problem, again, violence perhaps being one of the negative consequences?
Well, I think at the heart of the problem is the fact, as the Secretary General of the UN rightly pointed out, the fact that these groups are talking to each other, that Steve Bannon from the United States is in close contact with far-right groups here in Europe, and that European MEPs of different parties have realized that they have much in common, that Geert Wilders in the Netherlands or the new Vox Party in the Iberian Peninsula are meeting together and are discussing things together and realizing that they have common cause, which is to attack the white majority from a white supremacist point of view, so that they claim that the white majority is the establishment of Europe. But the white majority is not listening to the white minority, the white supremacists, who argue that the not only is white right, the white is best, and that therefore you should be better if you support the white people. And this is a narrative that appeals to certain people, particularly of little education, who have a lot of pressures on them at the moment, particularly during the pandemic. The unemployment rate has risen in Europe as it has in the United States, and not everybody receives the sort of help that is available from the government. And therefore, they are approving the sort of message that is coming across from a minority. It's a minority which has a voice and which is able, through social media these days, to communicate with each other as well as communicate with the general population.
Okay, my final question goes to you, E. Michael Jones. The statement that the U.S. Secretary General has made is in reference to the politicians who have this notion of white supremacy. How can, quote, we need global coordinated action to defeat this grave and growing danger. So what does he propose to do? I mean, what does he have as a game plan, do you
think?
What he's got
is a worldwide rebellion against the oligarchs. That's what's going on. India is part of this. The yellow vest, Brexit, Trump, all sorts of people are upset with oligarchic rule. These are not white supremacists. I'm trying to tell you, it's their category. If you collaborate by putting this label on people who are upset with the oligarchic rule, you're working for the oligarchs. It's a category of the mind. You should be able to see through this and see the political purpose behind it. If you can't, you're part of the problem.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Very enlightening indeed. Let me thank our guest, editor of Culture Wars Online Magazine, Michael Jones, there with his statements, and author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer. Pleasure. Talk to us from London. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Ikaba Tafwa, entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye.
We
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن لم تكن حليما فتحلم فإنه قل من تشبه بقوم إلا أوشك أن يكون منهم.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "If you cannot forbear, feign to do so, because it is seldom that a man likens himself to a group and does not become as one of them."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio,
the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great lessons and the most profound lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is how we need to inculcate piety, this thing called taqwa, in our lives. So, dear friends, taqwa, which is the Arabic word for piety, or is known as God consciousness or God wariness, or again piety, this God consciousness again is a word which we throw around sometimes, but we really don't know exactly what it means. We just nod our head. And well, today let me just really quickly talk about this God consciousness. God consciousness means, well, to be conscious of God, to be aware of Allah, that He is everywhere, that He sees everything, that He hears everything, that He knows everything. Whether we speak or we remain silent, Allah knows what is in our hearts, in our minds, in our thoughts. He sees our actions. And so this God consciousness, this being conscious, being aware that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a reality with all these kind of attributes, leads us, one, to refrain from committing sins, two, it encourages us to do good. And this equals piety, taqwa. So it is unanimously believed that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most pious man after the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Imam Ali alayhi salam was detached from the world, which he has, in his own words, divorced three times. And so they say divorced three times because after the third divorce, there is no way to return. Ammar ibn Yasir, one of the famous companions of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, as well as one of the most loyal and faithful companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the one who was killed, he was martyred at the hands of the forces of Muawiyah in the Battle of Siffin. Ammar ibn Yasir quotes the Holy Prophet Muhammad as saying, "Ya Ali, Allah Almighty has adorned you, beautified you with an ornament which was extremely praiseworthy with Allah. Whereas Allah has not adorned any one of His servants with such an adornment. And this adornment, this beautification is piety." So, dear friends, we need to try to inculcate taqwa, inculcate, make a part of our lives this concept called piety, this consciousness and awareness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. A beautiful lesson indeed brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن